We always say live. Am I
habit?
Is my volume coming in good?
It's coming in really good.
My sound is good. So my setup is such that my mic is quite a ways away, and I wasn't sure if it was going to sound okay or not.
It sounds good. The only thing I would say, if I was being critical, is it's a bit tinny. And that might be due to the distance, or it might be the reflective properties where you're at, but it just sounds a touch tinny.
Yeah, well, I'm in a tin can.
There you go. Yeah, no, that sounds way better. Yeah, that does sound better. Yeah.
Okay. I usually have a little pop
shield,
pop screen, because I talk quite sharply, so it helps to reduce that silliness. But
it sounds good right now. It sounds good right now. Yeah.
Yeah, I'll have to hold my mic for now, I guess.
Yeah. Well. Or do what I do, like get a freaking. I've got my laptop on a milk crate right now. I just haven't figured out. I've had it on a milk crate for a while here in my office, my laptop, and just trying to figure out what height I want it, where I want it. And I've got a proper kind of laptop stand, for lack of a better term. It'll be here probably today, but it's taken me a couple of weeks to decide how I want my laptop, where I want my laptop when I'm doing various recordings.
Yeah, well, definitely it's difficult to not be uncomfortable when you're trying to do this, you know?
Dude, it's already uncomfortable enough. I feel like I need someone hitting me with a palm frond, just like waving me, cooling me off here a little bit. I need all the tools sometimes.
To keep your ego in check, eh? Look at me just, on the computer.
no, just to make me feel like I'm not, I belong where I belong, and I don't deserve to be there, is usually what I'm saying. So bring on the palm fronds. If it makes me feel like I'm in the right place just a little bit more, then I'll
feed you grapes. Fronds.
That's right. Yeah. Honey, maybe some walnuts. I don't know. You know,
I feel like that's like, there's a story in the Bible about that.
The problem is an old
guy who was being fed grapes and living in his mom and dad's house until he was an old man.
That's right.
Hey, look at this! Is one of the mugs that I have left. Isn't that a nice one?
That's a good one.
Yeah,
where'd you get that from?
It was in the camper.
Oh, check. Yeah. That's hilarious.
Whatever's in here is what we've got so far. So
now, what's I'd asked you the question specifically in regards, and this is your own financial business, not mine. But did you have home insurance or not?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I mean, some people don't. It could have been not tragic, but it could have been freaking super bad without insurance.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that quickly. And first, I guess we should introduce the podcast because we never do. We're recording.
Oh, hang on a sec. Here we go. We're recording already. Okay. Didn't even know. Yeah. All right. Not paying attention.
Welcome back. Welcome back, everybody. We finally said it in within the first 2 minutes. whatever. I'm a bit, you'll have to forgive me. I'm a bit spacey, still reeling from what's happened, but home insurance, I bitched about paying for insurance my entire life. I've been paying for insurance for, 27 years now.
Man. Yeah.
And finally, I understand why it's so important and why you shouldn't complain about it, because I don't know what you would do if you weren't financially able to replace your entire life in a loss a loss like this, where you have a house fire or a major accident or something really catastrophic happens in your life. No insurance, man, no bueno. It would be really difficult.
It would be bad. It'd be bad.
Yeah. Now, I will say one thing. The amount of community support has been something that it's hard to describe. It's been absolutely incredible. And I mean, not just in this tiny little community where we live, which is, only a few thousand people, but beyond that, in the social media sphere, within the group of people that you and I interact with, and then on the fringes of that, and even farther out from that scope, it's been unbelievable the amount of heartwarming and humanitarian support that we've had. So I don't know how to say thank you enough to anybody who hears this message and who's listening. But if you happen to fall upon this podcast and you were one of the people out there that was supportive, my deepest gratitude to you. We have been able to get clothes on our kids and get bedding and the supplies that we need to live short term within a few days just by donations. And so it feels pretty good. It helps scrub your eyes and your ears of all the poison you hear on social media and in the news all the time, that everything is broken in the world, when in reality it's not. It's just the stupid elites that are broken. All the rest of us down here at the normal level, we take care of each other and we're really good to one another, really, when it comes down to the important stuff.
Well, you say that, but there is, that's your experience. That's your reality, and rightfully so, and duly deserved. And, you know, the outcome that you're seeing is the result of your life. You know, people want to say thanks to you. You're trying to say thanks to them, but they're trying to say thanks to you for just being a cool dude or helping them out back in the day or whatever the case is, wherever the donations came from, wherever the t-shirts came from. Just people trying to acknowledge you and your family, but not everyone gets that because, you know, some people fall through the cracks. Some people just aren't freaking cool people their entire lives. And then when things go sideways, you know, there isn't a tsunami of help because they wrote their own story over the decades of how that would play out when that moment happens. So, you know, it's not everyone is experiencing what you're experiencing, that's for sure.
Well, that's true. And, you know, one of the underlying principles that you and I have had conversations with, and so many people have, especially in the podcasting industry and on the collective, you know, there's an underlying principle that if you thumb your nose at life, it's going to do the same thing back to you. And you're right, it's difficult for people to understand that. You go through life kind of giving everybody and everything the finger. But when catastrophic events occur, if you've done that, then you're going to be kind of on your own. You're going to be alone in the world, or you'll be less supported. Whereas if you can integrate into living in a way where you're not so nihilistic and jaded, because it's easy to fall into that, Sean. We all know that. It's so simple to turn on the news, to be influenced by the negativity that we see globally, even locally, and then think that you can just give the bird to everybody and go and hide in your own cave and expect to live a wholesome life right to the very end alone and stuck in negativity and nihilism. And then tragedy will hit you and you'll be clawing at humanity for assistance. And you'll realize how freaking wrong and silly you were all these years, because we're all interwoven in this. And if you step out of that bubble of humanity and you're going to go it alone and be in your own cave, then when tragedy strikes, you're also going to be alone in your own cave.
It's a self-predicting reality, future reality. It's like you're carving your own future out. You know, the moment that somebody's house burns down, that they've spent their entire life flipping the bird to society. Well, society doesn't step up and help. And then that individual typically doubles down on flipping the bird. Now they're really angry that nobody helped them. Now they're double flipping the bird. And so the next time the house burns down, there's even fewer people show up, and then they're even angrier, and then it's triple birds. And so, you know, you create your own reality, man. Like if no one had shown up to your house, that's on you. That's kind of the classic doom on you, because you wrote that book, brother. You know, if people are showing up with the pot of macaroni and cheese and saying, we just want to come over and make sure you got some chow for tonight and we'll figure out the rest moving forward. Bam. That's the righteous chapter that you wrote like 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 1.5 years ago.
Yeah.
So, you know, as a thought construct or a thought exercise, I suppose, the interesting thing would be, you know, if you were to, and again, this is just a thought experiment. If you were to remove the accident, remove the fire out of the equation and just use it as a kind of a virtual result or a virtual outcome, you understand the totality of that virtual outcome and it's now just set off to the side as if it didn't happen, but you understand what it represents. Now, you invest an extra year into your community as a whole, into the world as a whole, into being good Jay as a whole. A year from now, the same fire occurs. My guess is even more people show up, even more macaroni and cheese, even more t-shirts, even more engagement from the people who track you on social media. It would be a larger groundswell of help if you invest in the planet, invest in the future of just being a freaking cool dude. I believe more macaroni and cheese shows up.
Yeah, I agree. Nihilism.
I'm stating that. I hope anyone doesn't get that twisted. That's not, you don't live your life like that in order to get more macaroni and cheese. That's just the natural outcome that you're not hoping for, because you don't want the house fire. But when things go wrong, you know, maybe it's the macaroni and cheese quotient. How much mac and cheese you get when things go sideways is reflective of how you did in life.
Mac and cheese. That's perfect. It's nihilism becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, just like you said. And there's not very many people. I don't think there's very many people that are that way truly and deeply. We've been having to go to Walmart and Canadian Tire and the laundromat and all over. We've been eating in restaurants and we've had people deliver food here. And so we've been really involved in the community. We've been everywhere, you know, all day long. And I haven't really run into anybody awful. It's all been positive so far. Now, I will say that being in a small community, like being in a small town, is a little different, right? News is news spreads faster. Everybody's involved in everybody else's gossip. That's good and bad. I'm not commenting negative on that. Everybody gossips to a degree. But without that, I don't know what a person would expect. You know, to live a life that's so jaded and angry all the time, what would you expect to happen if negativity occurs in your life or something bad happens in your life, right? You set this self up, like you said, you set it up for yourself. You curated your own negative bubble and you've pushed society away. And sadly, I think this is sad morally and ethically. We could debate this, but it is sad that society happens to turn a blind eye to those that are jaded and nihilistic and have thumbed their nose at life. Do they still deserve to be helped? Do, as a human being, should they still get the help that they would need? That's a very big debate. That's a very big question asked, right? It's like stepping over the homeless man's legs when you're walking downtown. Do you thumb your nose at that person based on their circumstances? I don't know. I feel like it would probably be in everybody's interest to have as much humanity as possible and then figure out a way to deliver that on their own moral and ethical level. But does a person need to be out there volunteering their life and doing good in hopes that if something happens, they get it back? I don't know if that's probably not the right way to be. And then the other, you know, there's maybe three parts to this. Do you be an ignorant jerk? Do you be the person that is a benevolent narcissist that only does good to try and get good back? Or option C, which is probably the most appropriate one, is sort of the golden rule, or the maybe an evolved version of the golden rule, where you just try to do good and then karma sort of sets the path for you and good comes back in the end if you need it. Seems to me that option C is probably the best option in that regard. And I think I've tried very imperfectly to live a wholesome life that way, very imperfectly. But I don't think it requires perfection. I just think it requires you to try to be human, to try and be a better person, to try and, you know, give the waitress a little bit of extra tip. Smile at the person walking down the street who might be having a crappy day. Stop getting so negative and bent out of shape when somebody else does something and you react to it, and realize that we're all living a life that's difficult and challenging, and we're all struggling in our own way. And we all have baggage and skeletons in our closet, yet we all come together in the right form when it's necessary. And I've felt that. And so you don't have to be perfect. You don't have to save the world. You don't have to be a celebrity. You just have to integrate into society with a smile and with kindness.
And I think what you got to do is you got to try.
Yeah.
And some people don't, buddy.
It's true.
You know, you make a case of narcissism or heading towards just not being a cool human, we'll call it. There's lots of uncool humans out there. And thankfully, I believe there's more cool than there is uncool, but there's uncool people out there to a degree where, you know, it's evil. And so there's all kinds of humans walking the planet, walking the sidewalk. And I'm just going to use the homeless guy laying on the sidewalk, the scenario that, as you described it, I saw it in my head. And that is, do you step over the homeless guy's legs as you're walking down the sidewalk? Well, in some instances, I do. And yeah. So, and in some instances, I don't. And that's probably the key to how I feel it. I see the world and how I work the world in this kind of a example. Because there's a time and place where you're new to something. That's your first time. And then there's a time and place when it's your 10,000th time. And so depending on how many spots you've put yourself in the world, depending on what you've seen and done, maybe when you see a homeless person and you have to come up to that, do I step over or not step over moment? If that's your first time, you'll probably get it wrong. Contextually, against 10,000 times later, you'll have a really good understanding of how to play that moment right for you, not for the person next to you, but for you. And so let's say the second time you go to step over someone's legs, they sit straight up and stab you in the leg with a needle. Okay, that's not good. You'll probably never step over quite the same way again. If you start to walk around, a guy steps out from behind the car and grabs you. And you know, it was a setup. And so it all depends on what a person's experience is. For me, if I'm walking down the sidewalk and there's no other way to get around, then I'm probably going to step over that dude's legs, but I'm going to eyeball him as I step over. And depending on what I feel, not what I see, not what I smell, not what I hear, but depending on what I feel in that moment, the vibe of the moment, if I think that it's the right thing to help this person or it's the wrong thing to help this person, I'll go with what I feel. Based on the pattern that I've formed over the decades of if this, then that. Yeah. And so I might not do it perfectly, but I'll do it intentionally. And I think that's the more important part of the conversation is when you're walking up to that person on the sidewalk and you're trying to decide, do you step over their legs or not? You got to be, there's so many things at play there. You can maybe assign a first priority is safety. Maybe the second priority is common sense. Third is whatever. Stack it up layer after layer after layer, depending on how you've lived your life and what you know. In that moment, it's what you feel is the right thing to do. But not enough people take the millisecond to consider what's the right thing to do right now. They'll be a step away from the person's legs as they're trying to decide, oh, how do I navigate? And then they're over. And it just... maybe it works out, maybe it doesn't, but there was no pre-thought because there was no pre-moment. And so everyone plays their game a little bit differently. And so I don't think there's any one solution for sure.
Yeah. It seems to me that one of the great problems that I see that almost everybody has in society, really we all do, is that we live on mostly on surface level reactions to life and surface level emotions. And we rarely seem to have the time to introspect and to think deeply about scenarios. This, the idea or the thought about the homeless person that you step over and you look down upon them and you roll your eyes in disgust, or you simply give them no regard, you know, you act like they're basically a piece of trash that's added to the sidewalk. Or you could run through a whole bunch of scenarios, Sean. You and I are somewhat similar in the way that we think, where we have a tactical background, so we analyze things on multiple levels, right? We've been taught use of force in every single way possible. Your fighting abilities are at an elite level, so that plays in. It's part of your experience, but that's also that's also an indoctrinated type of training. That's not you as who you are per se. That's something.
Not as a human. Yeah.
Yeah. That's not you as a human. That's training. That's higher level executive function, neocortex type of operational readiness, but that's not human. Right. So there's much deeper level to the philosophical idea that we are all human beings and how do we treat each other?
And that's why I said I use the vibe. Because yeah. On top of my vibe, as you just stated, there's many layers. And mm-hmm. So I can remove all of my layers in the moment just by simply projecting forward with the force, we'll call it, feeling the moment before I'm in the moment, getting a read on it, the vibe, and then acting accordingly based on the energetic feel that I get in the moment. And as I'm sure, just like you, with zero concern for the moment, because like if the dude stands up with all the needles in the world, I can handle that. If the guy's like only got 3 breaths left and he's about to die, I can handle that. If whatever is going to happen in the moment, I can handle it. So I don't have to worry. I don't have to be 10 steps away freaking out. I'm 10 steps away feeling the moment and making my decision on how I want to play the moment. Am I going to be helpful or not? Am I going to ignore or not? Am I going to, whatever I'm going to do, I'll decide that based on my vibe. And then I'll let my layers take care of the rest.
Well, and isn't that the conundrum then? Because all of the layers seem to stack on top of the humanity before you get to that layer, right? Even in this conversation that you and I are having, you keep going back to it. And it's not negative or positive. It's not bad or good. You keep going back to all of the different things that you've been able to use as evaluation tools in your life because of your plethora of experience. And I would say, similarly, my job experience has given me a certain heightened sense of what I see out in the world, right? Where there is sort of like a guard or a sentry that keeps you from dropping down into the level of humanity before you make some decisions on safety.
Oh, for sure.
Right. But the conundrum I'm talking about is at this deepest level, what do we do with people? How do we treat other human beings? We're always negotiating this when we interact with anybody. We're negotiating with the level of humanity that we're willing to offer them at the given, during the given experience. And the level of humanity that I think that we should all be observing and reflecting on is so often buried. And how do you keep that uncovered and keep it on par with all of the other things that you're thinking of at the same time? Because I believe that all of the layers on top of the humanity, the deepest level of who we happen to be, it's covered by all of these societal and cultural layers that we've developed and built, because we know that people get mugged. We know that people get stabbed. We know that there's bad dudes around every corner. So there is this guarded sense. And maybe that's just a natural thing, Sean. You talk about xenophobia and tribalism. Maybe that's why. Maybe it isn't that it's unnatural. Maybe it is natural. But at the same time, we also have been able to think deeper about our place in the world and how we interact with society and with culture and with the people that are around us. And we push against xenophobia and tribalism, or else we'd be stuck, right? We would never be able to go anywhere if we were afraid of everybody, if we are afraid of foreigners or anybody that looked different or anybody that lived a different lifestyle. We would end up building these little, well, we would go back to like tribalism. We would go back to always being stuck in our little echo chambers, in our little silos, and fearing the rest of the world. So there's a balance, I believe. Excuse me. It's kind of what I've been trying to think on in the few minutes that we've been speaking. There's a deeper level to humanity that we need to be connected to. You can look around the world right now and see how divided and polarized life is against its own existence. How us humans at this advanced level in the most technological moment in history are still living within the fear of tribalism and xenophobia, where we can't all come together to say we're one thing that's all working to do the same thing, which is live and figure out what that means and how life is magical and how we should cherish it. And yet we can't get there as a globe. It seems impossible and impregnable to break down these societal and cultural barriers and do away with xenophobia and tribalism when we're not at war with each other. We're not throwing spears at our neighbors. We're not, you know, running around shooting arrows at one another anymore. And yet this fear persists. And so we layer the ultimate, the thing that Plato talked about, which was agape love, which was loving humans because they are you and you are them. That seems to be at the deepest level is what Plato spoke of. And I've only read briefly on this. I'm no expert. So please, anybody listening, don't think that I'm some sort of professor in this. But there is this idea of agape love. If you had never heard the term, what it means is like an all-encompassing love for humanity because of the fact that we are humans. And we have every right and obligation to preserve and protect life because it's magical no matter how you believe that we've gotten it. And at this deepest level, you become connected to people no matter their resources, no matter their socioeconomic status, no matter who they are in life. And that is always overshadowed by all of life that has happened since we became consciously aware with our ego, and that we have a self, and that we are driven to care for ourselves and our immediate kin first, and then we give a little bit extra to the people around us, and then to our community, and then as you go away from that little circle of you to your family and your friends and your community, it seems to dilute that love. It seems to water down that agape love for the whole rest of the world and all of humanity around us. And rightfully so, I believe, but there's, you know, I'm talking about this moral conundrum in that we don't treat everybody as human beings. We don't treat everybody even as human. And it's not until you start to introspect and look at empathy as a way of navigating through this so that you can step over a homeless person's feet without being disgusted by them, feeling actually you could understand what it would be like to be laying on cold concrete with your legs extended, desperate for anything for life.
Well, you described utopia, which will never happen.
I agree.
You mentioned, you know, no one's running around with bows and arrows. That's not true. Everyone is on the internet.
Well,
the bows and arrows are now digital.
Yeah.
Rather than analog. And by the way, there's lots of analog bows and arrows going on out there. They're just in different forms. They're not spears and swords. They're ballpoint pens on documents, or they are dot, 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 whatever. There's all of the tools of trouble still exist, just in different forms. We're still tribalism. We're still xenophobic. We're still a lot of things. We're still cavemen. We're still our DNA.
Yeah.
And so, you know, ideally speaking, heading towards a utopic or utopia like existence, it's a grand vision to hold up high and maybe try to head towards, but we're a long way from it. That's for sure. Yeah. And I think one of the important aspects of that equation that is just keeping us so far away from the solution is the simple fact that not enough people understand our current algorithm, like currently how not cool it is out there for a lot of people, and the reason to change it. I mean, why change? Why change the game? Because the people who are able to change the game are pretty comfortable right now. And, you know, they've got lots of ballpoint pens and they've got lots of tools, and there's no real reason to serve anyone cake, as it were. So, I mean, a utopia will never be achieved unless everyone understands what that looks like and why we would head in that direction.
Yeah, I think I agree. I think utopia is, at this stage in life, it's impossible. It would require a psychological and mental shift, which I think is like an evolutionary step in the direction of AI, perhaps.
I was going to say 20 years from now, with the amount of humanoid robots and artificial intelligence that will be in existence, there will be a percentage of the population who will have full access to all kinds of opportunities, directional opportunities to get way closer to a utopia or get even further away from a utopia. So the solutions at hand today versus 20 years from now, those solutions will amplify the velocity of the decision-making process to go full left or full right or full up or full down. Like, it's only the scale of change is only going to increase. It's not going to slow down. And so the increasing velocity of the direction we're heading is, it's important to have these conversations now, I do believe.
Well, I think, yeah, if we're going to stay on like the idea of utopia and what, where we're going with society and how it's going to affect our humanity, I kind of think of it like the Vulcans in Star Trek, right? They become was it the Vulcans? Spock was a Vulcan, wasn't it?
Yeah, it depends on which way you're running this. If you're talking about less emotional and more logical, then yeah, Vulcan.
Yeah, well, and think about that. What is the great fallacy of humanity right now? It's our emotions. It's that we are using evolved wetware. I like the term wetware. I can't remember who coined that term. Some crazy scientist. We have software in our mind or in our brains, or you can call it wetware if you like, and that has been evolving in the animal kingdom for millions and millions and millions of years. We have programs that are deep within our DNA, and those programs give us the propensity for violence and for selfishness and tribalism and xenophobia. And the cultures that we developed before we were what you would consider, quote, modern humans, also promoted this kind of thing. And in order for us to reach the next level, we have to be able to have full control of our ego, this unidirectional, self-centered way of being. We all are this thing. We all are, we all watch our ego and see how it manifests in all of the scenarios. It depends if you think of the ego as the three-part system that Freud created, where you have like an immature standard and sort of a higher thinking trifecta of who you are, and the decision making that you have is this thing that you call you, that is the thing making all of the choices for you. It doesn't matter who you are. There's barely a person alive right now that's got full control of their ego, and there's barely anybody right now that can make decisions without emotion. You know, there's all of these philosophical and psychological mind games and thought experiments that you can have with people. And so often it's logic and rationality that goes out first, and then it's emotion that thinks about these things. You know, like the person who's tied to a train track and there's a switch you got to flip to save that one person who's your wife. But if you flip the switch, then it goes and it careens off the track and it kills 100 people. So is it better to save the one person or to save the 100 people because the one person is your wife? These conundrums that we have, these moral and ethical challenges, they're never going to go away until we have the ability to shut off our emotions. And our emotions seem to be attached to these deep evolutionary processes in us as a safety mechanism, as a way of us understanding the why we have a propensity to do this. Why would you guard your children? Why would you save your wife over 100 people? Why would you turn to violence? Why would you do anything that is maybe against the societal or cultural grain? It's because we lack control, because we're pre-wired when we're born. And then as we develop our higher level and we an executive function, which sounds like it takes up to 30 years to be pretty good at being under control and having a mature ability to understand, we still aren't there. You can't have utopia if you can defy logic and rationality based on emotions. And so going to the Vulcans, you see that this is an advanced race of people that have been able to do away with this. And their society is always just based on logic and rationality and science. And I think that's the only way to achieve a real utopia. And I don't think that humanity has the ability right now. It's going to require this augmentation with AI that we spoke on in episode 2, and or the evolution of humanity to a level where we do away with that naturally just by philosophical thinking. Friedrich Nietzsche has this idea of the Übermensch, or the overman. And he says that man is the tether between animal and Übermensch. And that cord is we are tied to our animal instincts and this want and this desire to be better than we currently are, to take humanity to the next level. And yet we're caught in this tightrope. Sorry, not a tightrope. We're caught in this tug of war, this tether between our animal instincts and our higher level being that we have the ability to achieve.
I think I'm going to throw this at you. So personally, I don't feel that the direction towards Vulcanism is a good direction for humanity. I wouldn't want to be a Vulcan, though sometimes I'm accused of being a little like one. But I just wouldn't want to be a full-blown Vulcan. And I'll use Captain James T. Kirk as the example as to why. He's my favorite captain from that genre. My wife likes Jean-Luc Picard. I think he's a nerd.
I'm with your really wife. Do. Sorry, man.
Yeah. I understand a lot of people are. A lot of people don't like Captain James T. Kirk's how he treats various people and how he treats various species and how he acts and how he talks and how he thinks. A lot of people don't like the way he does that.
Yeah.
But I do, because I understand that there's a place for a dude like him versus a Vulcan. And so, you know, the Kobayashi Maru problem to solve, you're not going to solve those kind of problems unless you're like a freaking James T. Kirk, like almost doing it wrong to do it right, or thinking so far out of the box that, you know, not everyone gets along with him. There has to be people who see the world through a different lens in order to solve problems that the world can't solve. And so there has to be Vulcans who see the world in a certain way in order to solve those kind of problems that a James T. can't solve. And so I think it takes a lot of diverse approaches to life or to thinking about life in order to solve life as a community. I don't think any one person is ever going to get it right. Now, to the Vulcan part, I think that AI is the Vulcan. And we are James T. Kirk. How about that?
Not bad. That's pretty good. Yeah. I've thought of utopia a lot. I've had some pretty deep conversations with my father-in-law, actually. I remember it was over a year ago, maybe even longer. We were sitting in the living room, and I don't know how it started to come up about utopia. And I honestly, I've been disgusted with the idea that of what utopia would be. I have no desire to see humanity ever achieve utopia. I'm simply speaking at this point. And the Vulcans to me is, and I think I agree with you, I wouldn't want to be in a Vulcan society either. I think there's something that would be stripped of humanity if we... Yeah,
fiery passion.
Yes.
A fiery passion for life. That'd be the first. I mean, there's a dozen things probably.
Yeah.
But that by itself is enough.
It's the spectrum of experience that I think would be lost, and the ability to fail and then continue, and a whole host of other things. The ability to be angry with somebody and then apologize or come back together to resolve something. Not everything requires logic, because love is illogical. Well, what would we do if we got rid of love? Where would humanity be if we got rid of love? And I don't think that you can achieve. I don't think you can achieve utopia without love. So I think that there's a bit of a paradox built into what we're talking about, especially with the Star Trek theme here, that the Vulcans, you know, and you can see if you're a Star Trek fan, I was a Next Generation guy. You can see those little moral challenges built into some of the episodes where, in the old one, like in Spock's character, for example, he struggles to understand why other people have love and how silly it is and what a wasteful emotion it is. but it seems to be the very thing that keeps a cohesion between people. Love has been written about for thousands of years, and we have no idea, no way to properly describe it. It's ethereal, and it is invisible, and you can describe it in almost any way with whatever language you're using. Love seems to have no definitive defining sentence to say this is what the thing is. But love is crazy illogical and so irrational. Who in their right mind would dedicate every fiber of their being to another person only knowing that they're going to lose that person, or the opposite? You're either going to be the one that is lost first, or you're going to suffer the loss. And how illogical and irrational to set yourself up for the ultimate failure, to be so broken down, you know, to lose a child or a spouse. That is illogic in itself. But I wouldn't want it any other way. I wouldn't want to not experience that. And I mean, if you were born into a society that was completely rational and logical, maybe you wouldn't know, and you would have to only see by, you know, vicariously observing another species or another form similar to you experiencing love, then you could comment on it. But since humans have this propensity for love, since it's built into us, it seems to be a natural process. I wouldn't want to lose that. I wouldn't want to lose my ability to see something beautiful and breathtaking, or to feel how deeply entrenched love is when you lose somebody, you know, when somebody passes away. The grief strikes you down in such a fashion that you, for a short while, feel desperate and alone and broken. And yet what that does is reinforces just how much you loved that person or the thing. I wouldn't want any of that taken away for a utopia, because I think a utopia can either only be done by two ways. You strip everybody of their emotions, or you do it by fiat. And then that's not utopia either. That's slavery.
Well, that's your perspective, man.
It is. I mean, and so I am nobody here, man.
That is not Spock's. That is not Spock's perspective. And so, but Spock still, I believe, has his own idea of what love is, though he wouldn't call it as such, because that would be illogical. But what he did have is a sense of duty, a duty to serve.
Yep.
So irrespective of, and Spock is an anomaly within the Vulcan structure, given that he's half Vulcan, half human. So he's got a little bit of emotion, but not very much. He's this, he's that, he's not all the things, but he's kind of the things. As a proper Vulcan, 100% Vulcan as the example. Okay. Can't really feel the all of the grief when someone dies, and can't feel the extremeness of the moment as you just described. So perhaps not getting the totality of the contextualization, but in a way, I'm sure they did, you know, as a theoretical model. Just the simple fact that perhaps love for them is serving your fellow starship member. Duty is love to some degree. Yeah. Service is love to some degree. As a Vulcan, you don't have to go and serve Starfleet Command. There's many other things that you could do, you know, be a Vulcan farmer, whatever. But some of them chose to serve the universe. And so it's a form of love, I believe. How does a unemotional person display love? Well, we actually have people in society that are close to Vulcanism, in the sense of they're kind of a bit dead inside. There's some veterans that have some Vulcanism in them. People that have like struggled so hard that they've had to shut down some of their emotional centers. Like it's hard for them to feel love for anything to some degree in the extreme cases. And so how to feel love? Well, if you can't feel it, then how to give love so that you can start understanding how love works? Well, certainly replace the word love with service, with duty, with serving your fellow man. Go out and I know it sounds so cliche, go and work in a soup kitchen for a day and start reconnecting to your fellow man. And don't call it love. Just call it your duty. Just serve your neighborhood for a day and see how that feels. Feelings. If you've lost your sense of feeling as a Vulcan, then figure out a way to go re-engage with your feelings externally through a process, not sitting in your basement and hoping that the feels are going to fall out of the ceiling in your lap, because they won't. You've got to go out there and seek. You've got to go out there, not adventure, but look for these experiences so that you can feel these experiences.
Yeah. So if you're replacing the word love with serve or serving or service, is it the same thing?
No, I'm not. I don't want anyone out there to get it twisted. It's not a one-for-one exchange, unless the person is in such a hurt locker that it's a one-for-one exchange. And so if a person is really struggling to even spell the word love, they just can't even spell it, there's probably a chance they can spell duty or service or help. And so help can be given. And then maybe that can grow into loving your fellow man. But for now, start by trying to be helpful or be of service, be useful, engage in action with those around you, pick up freaking garbage with your neighbor, serve your community. You don't have to call it love your community. And maybe over time, it'll build into loving your community. But anyone who's approaching Vulcanistic, unemotional, dead inside, hating on the world, this all sucks. If you can't find the love in you, find a little bit of service in you and maybe it'll build.
Yeah. Why I said that was you take the word love and you put the word someone after it. And then you take love away, like you said, and put serve someone or help someone. Is serving someone and helping someone a form of love, even though the word is spelt differently, and perhaps you're explaining it in your own mind in a different way? That so I'm just wondering. That's why I said that, because you were the one who said replace the word love with serve and go do that. Maybe that is a form of love, and maybe it's just easier for somebody to swallow that pill.
I believe
when you say serve someone, help someone. You know, instead of love someone, maybe you are loving them when you serve them. Maybe you are loving them when you help them, even if it doesn't feel that way to you. Maybe it
my
is
wife,
still the
My
form.
Wife is sneaking into my Podosphere HQ right now and giving is me she? The look like she's sneaking in. I love you, honey. And now she's sneaking out as if it didn't happen.
Oh, totally ruined the show. Totally ruined
the
it.
Heck?
I mean, at least her and I are Jean-Luc Picard fans together. So there we go.
That's true. She, yeah. You know, she gives me a hard time for being a James T. Kirk fan. And you know, to some degree, rightfully so, because, you know, he wasn't very good with the ladies. Well, he was good, but it, I mean, he was a bit of a jerk.
He was a little too good.
It was a little too much. And he was disrespectful, and he was, you know, kind of misogynistic, and he was, you know, it was lots of things. He was a flawed human. He was a flawed captain. We all are. I'm not saying that I'm not saying he's my idealized captain of the Enterprise. I'm just choosing him over the others who, as far as I'm concerned, were a bit weak, a bit limp wristed. And well, so, you know, you can, you can debate your way out of a galactic battle. You can debate your way out of it. But when the lasers are going past your left ear, it's time to start kicking ass. And James T is the guy to kick ass. And Jean-Luc Picard is the guy to still be, you know, open up another communication channel. I'm sure they'll stop shooting lasers at us soon.
Oh man. Well,
so, you know, okay, there's many ways to skin a cat, as the old saying goes.
Yeah. Kirk was, he was a bit more of a manly man, I would say.
Yeah. But and
culture also me, when his character was,
that's
written,
right.
Was
that's
more
right.
Manly to meet, man too,
to meet
right?
the time. That's right. Yeah. To meet that generational's, societal cultural expectations of what it meant to be a manly man. And so, of course, that doesn't fly now. I mean, it's back then, it kind of makes sense, but now it does not make sense. I do not hold James T. Kirk as my idealized sense of a man. I certainly don't at all. No. He demonstrates a ton of flaws, and he can almost be used in some cases as a poster child for never be that dude. But if I've got to make a choice between, you know, who I want on the command deck of the Enterprise when things are going sideways, I'm choosing James T. Kirk every time.
Yeah, well, I don't know if this is an archetype so much as it's written into our culture, but that you see this in a lot of characters, even real life people. You see a lot of people who are what you would say maybe is highly flawed because they defy logic or rationality in some of their decision makings, but ultimately it ends up leading them to success because they're unafraid of the chance of failure. And you see it in science fiction. You see it written into all of the, like in a lot of TV shows. You get the super intelligent 250 IQ, super smart brainiac, like the guy off of Big Bang Theory, Sheldon.
Okay. I haven't really watched the show. I'm familiar with it though. Yeah.
So Sheldon is like an ultra super genius. And he bases everything on logic and rationality, which is okay in a lot of scenarios. But then the guy, the hero of every story, the guy who ends up getting the girl and saving the day is the guy who says, our shields are at 10%. And if I do this thing, there's a 95% chance that we'll die, but there's a 5% chance that we won't. And if I do option B, we're going to be slaves for the rest of our eternity, and we're going to turn into the Borg, and we'll all be part of the hive mind or whatever, in keeping with Star Trek. And guys like Kirk are the ones that take the risk, the 5% risk, and then they win the day. And there's people all over the world now, and we're not talking about blowing ships up in outer space, but there's people all over the world who are smart and successful, and they're risk-taking individuals who are willing to lay it all on the line for something. And what propels them beyond the ultra-logical 200 IQ guy is the ability to defy logic and rationality. It's the ability to look into their instincts and say, no, I'm going to do it this way because I think it'll work. And sometimes they fail. I'm not talking about people killing other people on decisions, but you think of a lot of people out in the world that we see as celebrities that are highly successful, and they went for something way bigger, even though it was so irrational, even though it was at the time, everybody would have said to them, you're insane to think that you're going to do this. And then Jeff Bezos becomes the second richest guy in the world after working in his, you know, his one stall garage for 5 years. Or Elon Musk's story. You can go all over the world, and every country has examples of these enigmatic people who don't necessarily follow logic and rationality through to the end. They use something that we have as human beings, this mechanism that defies logic and reason and propels us forward on, I don't know, on gut feelings, Sean, on something other than instinct. I'm not sure. You've been around the block a little bit more than me, but you see these people, right? You see guys like Captain Kirk, and you see people like Spock that are the ones that end up failing because they logic themselves to death. Whereas the people that just say, screw it, I'm jumping, and they find out when they hit the water what's underneath the surface, right? Those are the ones that seem to propel society in the right direction, or their business model, or the experience they're trying to have, because they throw logic and reason out the window.
Yeah, got to be bold in life, man. But, you know, you're right on the money as you present it. But before I launch into it, I got to say that the cautionary tale is, for every person who jumps into the water unknowing what is directly underneath the surface, there's maybe 9 people who hit the water and then hit a rock.
Yeah.
And then the 10th person hits the water and goes deeply underwater and surfaces and does the rah-rah, sis, boom, bah, I'm a winner, baby. So, you know, there's all, there's... history is littered with corpses of people who dived into the water unknowingly. And yeah. So true. It takes more than just guts. It takes more than just blind faith. It takes more than just unknowingly leaping into the void. And so I believe that it takes almost no courage to jump into the murky water of the unknown. And it takes more courage to jump into the water knowing that there's a chance that there's rocks underneath there. And so some people will like be oblivious to the risk and also be oblivious to the cost of the outcome. And they'll just freaking go for it because they give it zero thought. But yeah. For the thinkers, like for using Elon Musk as an example or Jeff Bezos, someone who is intelligent enough and has thought about it enough, but then still goes for it, that's bold, man, because that's a person who's probably taken into consideration the risk matrix, the risk-reward ratio, and they understand that the risk is way bigger than the reward, and still they go for it. So that is something that impresses me. If James T. Kirk has done the math and still goes for the bold move, I'll respect it. But if he's just like looking this way and then decides, when I look that way, I just change the fate of mankind with no thought, I'm not down with that. And so who a person is, how much they think about the cost at the far end, that's important. I think the personalities at play, like a Musk or a Bezos or a James T. Kirk or the unknown dude at the end of the street, all of these various characters through their life experiences will decide the fate of their immediate surroundings through cost balancing. So you and I have lived different lives. Perhaps I've experienced an extra 20 years of life. And so my experiences, when I look at a problem, would be different than how you look at a problem. And sure. So my solutions might be grounded in more experience and might be maybe a little bit better of a refined solution. But the refined solution isn't always the right solution. And so no matter who you are, Bezos or Kirk or the guy down the street, eventually, even when you're making the right decision, it's not always the right decision. Sometimes it's the not only the dude who thinks outside of the box, but it's the dude who doesn't even know there is a box and just randomly comes up with a good idea that you had never considered and that I'd never considered, but is the right decision. And therefore, you know, that if we all think that we've got everything figured out, we're doomed.
Yeah. So, well, we wouldn't be here that's for sure.
For sure. And so why take a chance on the Kobayashi Maru? Why take a chance on solving a problem that's in our country or in our neighborhood? Why take a chance on even freaking podcasting? All of these things, all of these little risks, all of these little forays into life that would be better spent in some people's minds watching just Netflix. It's just safer. It's just easier. It's just less risk. It's just fill in the blank. Well, the things that I do, the Kobayashi Maru moments that I do, I like to think that they're worth my time because they're creating betterment beyond my time. So if I'm just running life that's good for Sean, that ain't enough for Sean. And so we get back to the full circle of the moment, and that is, What's your definition of putting love out into the world? Well, I don't think of it as love. I just think of serving my fellow man. And so if there's no harm in that, then it's for me or anyone that's listening that is into serving, how best to do that. My wife doesn't understand podcasts. In fact, well, she does understand podcasts, obviously, but she doesn't understand why I do as many as I do.
Yep.
And for her, it would probably be a waste of her time because she can spend her time doing other things that are probably creating betterment in the world. And to that point, yesterday, a friend of ours, a mutual friend of ours, that you know well, reached out to Doreen and said, "Hey, would you like to be on a podcast? Would you come on our podcast?" And she politely declined. And I didn't get involved in that situation. I just said, "Well, you know, think about it. You decide whatever you want to do, go for it. You know, if you want to, if you don't want to, that's, you know, you decide. I'm not going to try to influence you on that." And so I wasn't sure what she would do, but she again politely declined because it's not really her jam. Yep. She'll surf some other way, in her way, put out love how she likes to put out love. And so, you know, all of these things that are in front of us, all these Kobayashi Maru moments, big or small, they're for us to decide how we want to solve it and with what tool. And if you're solving it with love or serving your fellow man, then, you know, where's the harm?
Yeah. You don't agree with this necessarily, but I think that love is the all-encompassing and equalizing factor in that, that you can call it service or help or whatever you like, but ultimately, if you're in the circle of humanity and you're doing something for somebody else, I think it's a form of love.
It is, but my James T. Kirk brain won't let me say love too many times.
No, of course. Yeah. Yeah. Like you lose macho points.
Yeah. Like, no. I mean, if you're not like that. If love is once in a paragraph, that's enough. But once every sentence, too much for me, man.
Well, here's something that I was thinking of, and I was trying to allow you to really get your point across before I explored this idea. So I'm going to have to build it as we're talking, but
yeah, please.
We have to have people in the world that are these risk-taking people, or else we wouldn't be where we are now.
Oh, hell yeah.
Look at all of the foods out in the nature that we had to experiment with, and half of them would kill us. Somebody tried it. Somebody tried eating the poisonous mushroom before. That's how we know they're poisonous. Somebody tried experimenting with all the mushrooms, and we figured out which ones to eat. We lost a lot of human beings to deadly mushrooms. That's just one
history's example. Littered with corpse.
Yeah, and you got to be thankful to some of those people because they were risk takers and they lost their life in experimenting for the betterment of humanity.
Some not altruistic. Not all altruistic.
No, some for sure. Yeah, absolutely.
A survival. And so, you know.
Yeah, or maybe it was a way to try and get an advantage in a scenario. It might not be that the person was, like you said, was thoughtfully experimenting. They might have been mindlessly experimenting or very selfishly, narcissistically experimenting. But we are where we are right now because built into humanity is, in some level, a small percentage of human beings are huge risk takers. They throw logic and reason out the window and they do as they please or they do as they think they should for either themselves or for the betterment of people. And in doing so, they have propelled humanity in the right direction. In the right direction. I would say that overall, we've kind of pointed our arrow in the right direction as humanity has progressed. But you're right, we walk upon the corpses of everybody who has experimented in order for us to survive. Mm-hmm. Hundreds, thousands of iterations, thousands of generations of humans before us have experimented with all of life's abilities and availabilities. And in order for us to know, you don't jump off cliffs, you don't put your hand in fire, and you don't eat that magic mushroom. Otherwise, you're dead. And somebody did that for us. And there's people every day making these wild choices so that everybody else doesn't have to. It's built into it. It's almost like it is an archetype. It's almost like it is a genetic sequence or a part of our DNA that some of us have this jump into the water without knowing mentality, and they're okay with it. And it's almost like soldiers.
Yeah, that's really what I was thinking.
It's like soldiers or anybody who's going to strap on and say, "I'm willing to die for another person." That's the biggest risk that you can take. I will trade my life to save yours. I don't know if there's any greater way, of serving or of being one of these risk takers, and there's not very many of them. Mm-hmm. With a population of 8 billion, how many humans can you muster together that are right now alive that would do that? Not a whole lot, right? You'd have to basically go to the service industry and see those that are strapped on, that are doing this on the daily basis, risking their lives for others. Those are the risk takers. And maybe they don't put on a police uniform. Maybe they do something else. Maybe they take risks financially or with their reputation because of the business they're in, right? Mm. It might not be that they're standing there saying, I'll take a bullet and save you. I'll go to war to save my country. Maybe it's, I will literally lose everything in order to try and solve this problem and in trying to be successful in this thing. Some people just have that in them. You and I think, are an example of that. And I'm not trying to claim to be a hero. It's just my path ended up here. So did yours.
Yeah.
But it seems to be built into society and a requirement for us to have gotten this far.
Yeah, you know, and so I think that one of the other aspects, the virality of service, or virally spreading the word on service. So, you know, another little conversation that came out of last night, speaking with Doreen about, you know, maybe you'll do a podcast in the future, dear. Maybe on a platform that is, you know, just couples talking to couples, and then you can represent as my poor wife that had to put up with me all these years. Yeah. And so I'm not sure if she'll ever be on a podcast, but if Doreen was on a podcast, it would probably have a bigger impact than I would have in that episode. And that's because I know, like, in my DMs on a regular basis throughout the week, there's a number of ladies who just track what I do, but track my family, track Doreen. Like, whenever Doreen shows up, you know, bunny hopping around on a Brazilian jiu-jitsu mat, well, I mean, the troops, the ladies are into it. They're tracking what they're seeing. And so whenever she has a little cameo on a mountain bike or whatever, the ladies are stoked. And so it's not that everything that I say as a man is brushed off to the side and all of the ladies are desperately waiting for my wife to show up with the wisdom. That isn't the case. But there is a virality of service. There is a virality of duty. When anyone who tracks me sees Doreen trying to in some way be in the game, it's a nod of recognition for her. Whereas myself, as an example, I'm almost like a boring old face now. They're so used to seeing it that it's like it's barely happening. When she shows up, it's a special occasion. Yeah. And so I think that there's a need for these kind of moments where maybe your wife shows up, my wife shows up, some, you know, if it's a female podcaster, her husband shows up in the background, you know, with an apron, hopefully a French apron with all of the frills. I think it's important that our partners show up, not in the background, in the foreground, in all the ground, from time to time, so that people understand that they can engage their spouses or their partners or somehow demonstrate more service out to the world. What do you think?
I think that we serve our spouses. So, you know, you said this a short while ago to me, and it kind of bummed me out for a little while. And
I'll tell you, it's what I do.
Yeah. Hey, good. It's good, man. No, it's okay. Yeah. How you do one thing is how you do everything, you said.
Yeah. That's right.
And then I had to reflect on that, because there's a lot of things that I do mediocrely. And so now I'm having to figure out why do I do certain things with a level of mediocrity in it. It's been kind of troubling me, honestly, because that's an evolution for me. it's a level of maturity. And when we were, you know, you can be the jack of all trades or you can be the master of something. And we serve people, and the person that we should serve most righteously is our spouse. They should be the number one thing. They should experience a level of love from us that is like no other. And I think when your wife gives that little cameo experience, people see Doreen in your space, and your space, and I'm using you as the example because you're part Vulcan. Your space is something that people who track you know what you're like, right?
That's right.
They know that they know about your drive and your propensity to break things down right to the bitter end, that you have a tenacity. They don't know and they don't see the gentler, more soft side of Sean, which I'm sure comes out with your spouse.
Yeah.
And I would say a very similar thing. I noticed that there's a massive uptick in, I hate this, but the way that the way that you kind of gauge social media is in the interaction you have with others, right? Whether it's liked or viewed or whatever. And there is a massive uptick when I do any kind of social media posting with my wife. There's something that people are drawn to, that if you're showing what your marriage is like, they're taking that, just like that quote you said, how you do one thing is how you do everything. If you are showing the world that the gravity of your marriage is like a black hole, then they're going to know that the relationship status that you carry with all of the rest of your life is something that is probably quite intense. Mm-hmm. You're providing a level of vulnerability, I think, in that. And that's what's so attractive about it, is that you're showing people that you can be an elite status, sort of hard-hitting, masculine, very masculine kind of person, and yet you can have a tenderness and this all-encompassing love for your spouse, which I don't think should be embarrassing. I think it should be promoted and shared. So I like when I see that. I agree that it's something that people are drawn to because it shows a side of you. And it's a very attractive side. Mm. I've had people comment privately to me about my wife and I, thinking they only see what we put out on social media. And yet, based on that, their perception of that is that we have this deeply gravitational relationship. And I would say my wife and I do. We've managed to survive a lot of adversity in our marriage. And my wife isn't behind the camera either very often. She's not really into it like your wife is. She doesn't podcast at all. But those times when I make little videos with her, there's a lot of gravity to them. There's a lot of attraction to people, because it's not just showing this rational side or this thoughtful side or a philosophical side or a strong side or a motivational coaching guiding kind of side. It's a vulnerable side. It is sort of like the last bit of the equation that completes you. And what is that? It's your spouse. And it's the love that you have.
I think that that's all true. But I really do think that a large part of it is something completely different than all of that. And it is people get to observe the self-help book that may or may not be right for them. And so how many people do you know that are married? Most people.
Yeah.
Do you remember picking up that book on how to do marriage extraordinarily well?
Yeah.
And do you remember that book called How to Raise Perfect Kids? Mm-hmm. You know, there's so many not helpful things out there on how to have a good life and how to have a good marriage and how to have a good kids. There's so many helpful, but there's way more non-helpful things out there.
Yeah.
That it all just kind of becomes white noise eventually. And I don't think a lot of marriages know how marriages are supposed to be in our modern world. And I do believe that's why folks getting contextualization against people that they maybe know to some degree, like if they know me to some degree, then they get to have a cold eye review or a fresh set of eyes on another marriage and wonder, is that a good marriage or is that a bad marriage? Is there something I can take away from that marriage? Is there something that Doreen knows that I don't know that gives her a secret sauce on how to deal with dudes like Sean? And so people get to read a book in a podcast. They get to read a book as they watch a 2-minute clip with Jay and his wife. It's the book called You Can't Buy It on a Shelf. You can only watch it in a video and learn as much as you can or not learn anything. But yeah. To me, when I see couples together, I'm looking for the dynamics between the couple. I'm less interested. So I'll use Dean Stott and Alana Stott as an example, who mm-hmm. were recently on the Collective Podcast. And so I'm less listening to what both of them say, and I'm spending way more time observing the invisible dynamics between the two of them, because that's what interests me. Because many years ago, I stopped listening to the obviousness of the words. I mean, there's very little in the words once you've listened to a lot of words. To me, it's about the vibe, the synchronicity, yeah. the invisible energy that's moving back and forth between the individuals that no one sees unless you actively seek to see the invisible messaging between the two parties. The words sometimes are boring to me. The energetic flow, the invisibility of the moment, that's what fascinates me. So that's what I look for in couples. I'm not looking for what the wife says as the pro tip. I'm looking for the invisible energy between them as the pro tip.
Mm. Yeah, I've got a good example of that. And I was younger, so it took me a while to recognize that I had observed something specific about a couple before I knew that there was a deeper backstory. I was with some family. There was a married couple, and the husband sat down beside the wife by a fireplace on the hearth. And I noticed that when he sat down and touched her leg, that she shuddered and jumped.
Mm.
Didn't think anything of it at the time.
Oh, really? Were you a police officer then, or?
I was just a policeman.
Ah, okay.
Just. Okay. Maybe within about a year.
Okay, check.
Didn't think anything of it, really. Oh, startled her. Anyways, several years later, that gentleman was charged with a whole host of domestic assault charges.
Yeah, of course.
And the very first thing that came to my mind was that moment that I observed. Mm-hmm. That's what I was seeing. Mm-hmm. That's why. And so unfortunately, as a police officer, it's hard to shut off your investigative tools, the powers of observation, the things that you see. You try to observe a person's psychology through their actions, not through their words, right? There's tells in body language and 100%. In the way that people interact with one another without language, without the use of words. And yeah, you're right. You can see that. And perhaps I think it's bold perhaps for me to say out loud, but I'm satisfied that my wife and I have a rock solid marriage. We've been through so much in our 12 years together. And I think people see the comfort we have in each other in problem solving, that whenever we're around each other, doesn't matter what the world is doing. Doesn't matter that the world is on fire or that we've had a house fire or that we've struggled with this or that. Her and I seem to just be on the same plane where all of that is just the noise around us, and our union is never compromised. So I feel like when I'm around my wife, whether we're in public or not, there's a sense of peace. There's a harmony that her and I bring to one another, that it is the right equation. And I think people they vibe on that, and they can sense it, and they can see it within social media or within your friends and group circle. And I think it's because they pick up on those little cues. the micro expressions in the face and the body language and literally the energy you give off as a couple.
Yeah, for sure.
Right. I mean, I've all my friends are married. I know all everybody's dirt. I know everybody's dirt in town. And not, of course, not anymore, but I used to. So yeah, I was able, I had the good or bad, I had the ability to observe how people acted in public, knowing their dirt in private. And then I could see it. And then I developed this ability to see the observations and correlate them with what I actually knew how they were behind closed doors.
Yeah.
Well, then it's very simple for me to see what those body language cues and those micro expressions are like. You can tell, and then you can bring that out in the world, and you can see that in all relationships. You can see that in a friendship you have. Yeah. If you're the intimidating one and you're the asshole, pardon my language, you'll eventually see why people act a certain way around you.
Yeah, for sure. 100%. Right?
Yeah. And so it's interesting if you observe people and how love unfolds in their relationships, you'll see something deeper in that if you pay attention.
Yeah. And so, you know, like if there's people that are tracking you as a couple or my wife and I as a couple, I think like reality TV, there's probably a little bit of entertainment in it. There's a little bit of escapism in it, perhaps, even if it's only for 10 seconds or whatever the case is. But I do believe at a deeper level, humans are seeking to connect to other humans in whatever way they can. And even if they're the biggest jerk in the world, even if you're freaking Darth Vader, there's got to be a little bit of a shred of humanity in Darth Vader that he wants to connect with someone around him. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's through a force choke, but I think that all of us are trying to connect. And so
I did my force choke.
I liked how you bore your teeth.
Oh, I really got to get the mind into it.
You got to get into it. Yeah. I think that we're all just trying to connect. And so the connecting through a brief exposure of your wife on a podcast is still connection. And so if she can do backflips in the background, so there's some entertainment, good. She doesn't ever have to say a word.
Yeah.
Good. And so now there's people who see her in your life having fun. She doesn't have to say a word. And somehow through that 10-second backflip moment in the background, if they never see your wife again, that's the image that they have in their minds, is your wife is a fun person who's athletic, and they build out the avatar. They'll be building it out for 2 days straight if they had time to build it out.
Yep.
They only need to see her for 1 second, jumping up in the air and hitting a light switch, whatever, some random moment. And they will build that avatar out into something that sometimes is barely close to the truth. And so I think that, you know, if my wife never goes on a podcast, if she's never seen on the internet again, okay. But I prefer the idea that in the future, there'll be more exposure of my wife to people who know me, so that she can be closer to her actual avatar rather than the 2 to 10 second blip that people will build out into a non-realistic avatar.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to have to get going here, unfortunately, because of the circumstances, there's lots to do for us. But that's unfortunately how we all build the characters of our life, with little snippets of them without really knowing, a deeper reality to them. And you can get a sense of that, like we said, if you can cue into those body language, communications, if you can learn to read the energies of people, then you can kind of see whether your idea of them is more or less true, right? You know, it's kind of the old saying goes, you know, never meet your heroes, right? Because you don't know, all you see is them in movies or TV or on social media, and then you meet them in a real person and they're an absolute jerk.
Yeah.
So I like that idea. I think it would be great for people to see more Sean and Doreen.
Oh no, because, I was referring to you and your wife, not Sean and Doreen.
Oh no, no. I was referring to you.
No, I'm referring to you. Yeah.
No, no, you. You can be you can be Kirk and I'll be Picard, but you definitely, well, I don't know if he didn't have a wife, clearly, or else she was a very understanding woman. Definitely not the Sean and Doreen marriage.
That's definitely not.
You kind of brought it back to you brought it back to community, which is kind of how we started this off, and it was as a result of my circumstances that we started this conversation, kind of ticking on that. So let's finish it off right here. I just want to say thank you again. It's a bit selfish of me to use the podcast to do that, but there has been so much incredible help, and it is because community, and it is because I have. And I would like to say that it's not selfishly. I would like to say that I have been selfless in my service to people. But selfishly, I like serving. Mm-hmm. Selfishly, it brings me peace and a form of joy to serve others. I like to see people when they are happy. I like to see a smile on a person's face when I help them. So if that's what selfishness is in this, then I'm guilty as charged. And I think the key takeaway, if you've listened this far, is that whatever happens in your life, whatever is going on in your life, if you can connect with community, however big or small, it will improve your life. Humanity is the key to humanity. In this strange paradox, we as people need other people in our lives. And if you live the nihilistic, jaded path, you may find that life becomes dark when you need life the most. And I think we all need to reach out our hand across the aisle. We need to step over people's legs with empathy, and we need to be more as much involved in our community as we can based on our circumstances and the energy we have and the abilities that we have. And in doing so, I think we enrich our own lives selfishly. Okay, as long as you're not harming anybody and you're doing it for the right reasons, and selflessly, because you can give back to people and you can pay it forward someday. And I sure hope that I can pay it forward someday, because so many people have helped us out.
Well, you and your wife are a fine example of a perfect case study of, as you just laid it out, Jay. So, you know, I think it's great that everyone stepped up to help. But it's a due result of everything that you and your wife have done. So it's a one-for-one exchange. It's karmically correct how this is playing out, that people are supporting you within your communities, and it's as it should be.
It is how it should be, because the community should help everybody. And we'll end it right there.
Right on, buddy.
Live long and prosper.
Nicely done.
Thank you for joining us upon the horizon, and I really hope you see everybody on episode 5. Cheers.
Cheers.
Uh-oh. Got to end recording here. Hang on.